the Building Better Relationships Journal and Meditation. We created the Building Better Relationships Journal and Meditation so you can magnetize the better relationships you want and focus on the positive role that you have in creating a better life through your relationships. We are excited for you to discover the gold within you that can help you manifest the love we all crave. The Building Better Relationships Journal has coaching questions that help you listen to the truth of what you want and what helps you to be empowered in love. The Building Better Relationships Meditation is designed to strengthen your heart's ability to be that change you wish to see in the world. Why not download it now and think of it as a gift to those you love? If you love journaling and meditation, this is for you. Welcome to Building Better Relationships at Home and at Work with Angela and Patty podcast. This is Patty, a leadership and work-life balance coach from Arizona, USA.
And this is Angela, love and relationship coach from Sydney, Australia. And we are building better relationships with you.
Sharing new perspectives on being heart-centered at home and at work.
So you can draw on your inner power to make your relationships and the world a better place to be around.
Welcome to Building Better Relationships at Home and at Work with Angela and Patty. This podcast episode, Angela Ambrosia will share her journey with listening to the body, heart, and self. Angela Ambrosia is an energy healer, movement meditation, and dance facilitator at Dance with Angela, and teacher on loving relationships. She lives in Sydney, Australia. She teaches online classes and private sessions to open you to your healing gifts and natural joy. She works with people to develop their intuition and spiritual growth. In 2019, she experienced a near-death experience after going into a coma from an aggressive cancer. To the amazement of her medical team and friends and family, Angela survived. In the years since her recovery, Angela realized how she denied her own knowing that she was not going to die because she believed what the hospital thought was true. She is aware of how much we allow the power of others' beliefs to overshadow our own, even to the point of denying our own life. She encourages others to learn how to listen to your inner voice while also inviting and creating spaces to share yourself with others and experience the true connection. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Patty. Thanks for making me do this.
Well, thank you for doing it. I appreciate it. And so do our listeners. Angela, please tell us and the listeners about you, your journey, and why you became so passionate about movement as a way to discover self-acceptance and love.
Well, I started moving when I was very young, as a child, in my bedroom, around my house. I had an Italian family with a big house, the palazzo. So I used to dance around the house and feel like a little princess and sing. And I grew up in the 70s where there was a lot of pop music that was romantic. I was a big romantic. But I really discovered as a child a lot of freedom through movement and play acting and having those fantasies about what the songs were suggesting and what my imagination would encourage. And then later on, as I started having friendships and was in the world, I was extremely shy. So I realized that for me, movement was a place of freedom or creativity where there was no limits. And I wanted to be a dance performer. But growing up in an Italian family, I was indulging in a lot of good food and I was quite overweight and I wasn't really encouraged to dance as as an art form. So I waited till I was older. I was 21 and then I started taking dance classes and I started really discovering my body after many years of, I think I tried to do fitness training, but it didn't really work for me. And so when I started dance in a more professional capacity, I was doing shows, I was doing theatre, I found there was this, again, that freedom in movement that I couldn't have in my personal life. If I was speaking with people or if I had relationships, romantic relationships, I had problems, but in the dance I had this freedom. And eventually I wanted to understand what was that gap? Why, when I was moving, when I was using my imagination and creativity, I was completely happy. And then why in my personal relationships, I was constantly struggling, dealing with shyness, dealing with a self. I didn't really like myself. I had a low self-esteem or low opinion of myself. But when I was dancing, that all disappeared. So that was a mystery to me, that the two could coexist really stumped me. It was very confusing, even to the point a couple of my friends would say, "You're so different when you dance. Your face changes." My body would change. I did shamanic movement as well. So sometimes when I did shamanic movement, it wasn't a barrier to me to do that. The teacher said, "Let's just step into this different experience of your body." And I would just go there. My body had no resistance to it. So the other thing with dance that still fascinates me is that there are some people, not everyone relates to dance like I do, I've discovered, but I have this natural attunement to dance. I can feel a culture through the music. Or if you put on Gene Kelly movies, I can feel him dancing. So that was the other thing about dance and how it made me understand there was a part in the movement that allowed me to understand something other than myself. It took me outside of myself, but more than that, it gave me a journey to understand another dancer or another culture. So how does that gap that I was talking about, you were asking about the gap between self-love, how did I
so with movement as a way to discover self-acceptance and love. So from what you were saying, you found within your own journey that you became, when you danced, not a different person, but you could feel the music, you could feel the culture, you could totally feel when your body was moving in the dance and in the music. So in
and
your
I felt
journey,
no judgment.
In your journey as a healer and a teacher, you started out as a dance performer, like you said. What did this role teach you about how to listen to the messages from the body and how this can impact our health and happiness? And why do we struggle with acceptance of our body?
Yeah, that's the gap where I really started to see when I was experiencing the dance, I could fully feel. And there was no judgment. There was no filters saying, don't do this, don't do that. In some of the shamanic dance, I became another body. My body changed shape, or I would become a different form. That's what shamanism does. You can dance a different animal, or you can dance a different spirit. embodying a certain energy, so I could actually transform. And there was no internal dialogue saying, no, don't do that. It was the opposite. It was actually like this deep embrace of myself. So I saw how in my regular everyday life, there was the inner dialogue that was full of a lot of anxiety, a lot of negative self-talk. And that as a dance performer, when I completely embodied this other energy, could be a character, I had a filter that needed to be embodied fully. So, for example, I used to do, this is one of my roles. I've had a very colourful life, but as a character performer, I had to get dressed up as a gypsy and I'd have to do tarot readings while I was walking around. So normally as a tarot reader, you sit down, but we were given this extra challenge to actually carry the cards, walk around and do a quick reading. And I had to engage with people and ask them to do something, which is a little bit different, a tarot reading. But because I had the character, I had no
fear,
hesitation. Yeah, I was like, all right, let's, you know, I put on maybe an accent. Sometimes I didn't have an accent. I would just allow whatever my fantasy would allow that persona to come through. And then another role I used to do, I got involved with some people through Comic-Con in the early stages of Comic-Con in the USA. So I got to meet a lot of people who were doing this strategy where they completely embody this other persona. They might be slightly on the spectrum or have other insecurities about themselves. But once they embodied that persona of a character from Star Trek or some other comic character, science fiction character, their personality could blossom. So what I started to see was that the inner dialogue when we weren't in those characters used to come in very loud and clear. When I was with friends who were very insecure, they were stepping into a different character and they had this freedom. But outside of the Comic-Con or when we were in our regular life, the inner dialogue was interacting a lot. And it was also creating, what I started to see was that inner dialogue create a lot of problems in relationships. So especially because I had friends who were on the spectrum or friends who had just in general insecurities about themselves, I could see how their relationships were suffering a lot. Mm-hmm. And that means some of the relationships would break up. There would be betrayal. There would be relationships that people would feel heartbroken about. There was a lot of problems. And I used to find a lot of people thought this was normal. And that was one of the things that triggered me. I used to think, how come people are used to this? They're used to bad things happening in their relationships. They kind of have an expectation that that's a part of relationships. So I found that inner dialogue was something that we don't listen to enough. We don't listen to what are the thoughts that are constantly like a record playing over and over. And because I had to perform, I wasn't just getting dressed up for fun, but I had to be a professional as well. So that was a good context because then I had to see, well, how is my inner dialogue perhaps interfering with my capacity to perform? How is it making me limited or taking a long time to get something done when it should be just natural? That was the big thing I learned from dancing socially, improvised dance and professional performance, is that when I'm natural, things just happen. I would just perform naturally. There was no interference. But if I had certain inner dialogue about expectations, about making people happy, about people liking me, about being good enough, that would come in and make everything problematic, make everything longer. So that's why I started this journey of listening to the body. Mm-hmm. And part of that was the inner dialogue, But what happened when I started to listen to the body was underneath the inner dialogue, it's a very non-verbal part of the body, which I have a good ear for, but it's that part of the body, I think, before language, where we start to feel our emotions without thoughts. So, Patty, you know about Reiki and healing work. You know, when you might be working with someone, you get a feeling of sadness.
Right. Yeah.
I was doing that since pre-birth, I believe. Mm-hmm. I picked up a lot of stuff in utero, as we all do, inside our parent mother. And that's the feelings that I was starting to have, especially because I did a lot of work with people in dance. So I would dance with someone and I would get this sensation. And I didn't know if it was sadness, or I might not get an image, for example. Some intuitives get images. I do sometimes, not always, but I'm a kinesthetic intuitive, and I would feel feelings. And that's when I discovered that once you feel a feeling, as a dancer, what happens is that you react to the feeling and mm-hmm. you move, or you express the feeling through your body and your face, or the rhythm of the movement. You will have a reaction to the person if you're dancing with someone in right. space. You might turn away from them, turn to them. You might pull away from them, or you might pull towards them, or you may just feel that feeling inside your body. So this world opened up where I started to realize that beyond the inner dialogue, which is our thoughts and our garbage that we pick up from our conditioning in life, was this universe of the body itself, which is before language, and it's quite profound. And as a dancer, it actually is one of the foundational expressions of dance, because you're not reacting from thought, you're reacting from feeling, and you're experiencing the feeling and then bringing it into an expression, which means that you can, any day, you can feel different. So your dance is different. And that's what I also, having done many different dance forms over my life and dancing in different situations, in different cultures, different movement forms, the movement form itself would bring out a certain expression, a certain feeling. And I saw that the variety meant that because you're using a certain approach to the body, that also flavors how the body responds. So the body for me became this huge vessel or artist canvas that could teach me not just about myself, but about the human experience. And if I was working with someone, it created another creative canvas between us, between two people, any two people, it'll be a different canvas that you're working with. And that's what I brought to my healing work, because then it meant I stopped trying to do healing and I started to wonder, what is this moment between me and this person? What is that? And just to experience it, which brings a lot of things that a lot of healers, I think you know this being a Reiki practitioner, that moment where you're just in the energy, yes. You know that feeling?
Yeah.
That's what became my next obsession, because once I discovered there was this gap between my personal relationships and performance, what I discovered was that all we really, really want is that feeling that you get when you're just in the moment. That's all we really want. We're looking for it all of our lives. Some people go into an existential crisis, like, why are we here? But when you're just in the moment, you don't think, you're not looking anymore, you're in the moment, and there's just pure joy and there's potential for almost anything. And that became my secret to the health and the happiness that we're looking for. We're just trying to be in the moment, and we've gone this big circuitous path to get away from that,
right?
And the dance brought me right there, and it never fails. That was the other thing with the dance I found really strange, Patty. It didn't matter who I was dancing with or where I was, that ability to be in the moment came immediately. That's what was shocking, because people spend their whole life trying to find it, and I could find it in a heartbeat. So
yeah, I know for me, when I've went out dancing with friends and stuff like that, that is, being on the dance floor and dancing is one of the most happiest experiences. You're just like in a high, you know, of,
yeah.
And you have a lot of connection too, because you're dancing and you're having fun with your friends. And it just, everything else, you know, all your problems, everything is just gone in those moments when you're dancing, I find, for me personally. But it's yeah, such a fun experience, and I love it. And for me, I also, songs, I really, really connect with the words. When I hear a song, I really truly connect with it. It's the most oddest thing. And my husband says, why are you getting so emotional? It's just, words touch me, you know, in such a profound way. I don't know if you feel that too, Angela, when you hear a song or you're dancing. And
I experiment a lot with songs of different cultures that I don't speak a lot of languages. So actually I do both.
Mm-hmm.
When I grew up, I listened to a lot of pop music, and I felt the words and the love, a lot of romantic songs. But recently in the last 20 years, I've been listening to a lot of world music, and there's something also beyond language that I've discovered. So for you, Patty, that reminds me of like your affirmation cards, how words really resonate. And there is a lot of research about the vibration of language and how it reverberates for us. So language has this enormous power, but it's actually quite an enormous field of work in linguistics. They study it. And if you look at some of the sounds, if you look at spiritual music, some of the mantras and the sounds, mm-hmm. they actually are similar across many cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the Sanskrit chants are very much connected to some of the Middle Eastern chants, and also some other sounds from other tribal cultures. So there is something to do with words. For me, are often connected to that emotion that we have before we even put a word to it. And if you look at spiritual languages or sacred languages, they look at the thought, then they put that goes into the sound. So in the Bible, it says in the beginning there was mm-hmm. the word.
Right.
What does that mean? A lot of spiritual religions, cultures say that that's actually the thought that went, that was behind the sound. And from that sound, then the physical world was created. So we're still at the beginning of understanding that. It's quite a deep work that's been explored. I do Sufi movement and Sufi dance. And if you look at Sufi musicians, they're from many different countries. So say an example of, I had a Sufi master, he was from Baghdad, but he didn't like musicians from Pakistan necessarily. He didn't relate to their music.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's very different. It's the opposite. I mm-hmm. feel the music and I just love the feeling of the person singing. I go beyond the sound to the person
mm-hmm.
and try to feel what they're feeling. But for you, that could be in the word and hearing it and how it echoes, or it moves, the word moves through you, what it triggers.
Right. So that leads into my next question. a lot of people struggle with prioritizing other people's opinions and perceptions over theirs. So can you share an example of how we can listen to our inner self and intuition instead of pleasing others?
Yeah, I think actually it's interesting you brought up that thing of your partner, for example, saying, oh, why do you get so emotional about this? And I have a similar thing with movies. So I'm very visceral.
Yeah,
me and too. Kinesthetic. So yeah. I'll watch something on the screen. I have to turn away from most modern movies, unless they're a drama with a storyline and everything violence off screen. I have to physically turn away. I just turn in preparation, right?
Yeah.
So sometimes that, what do you love? You were sharing also about the words, something resonates for you. But what happens when we grow up is that you might really resonate with something or love something. You might love carrots, but your friend goes, carrots, I hate carrots. So when we're young, that's a fairly common occurrence. You might really resonate with something, but because you're young, you want people to like you, or you want the teacher to think you're the best student in the class and they think you're an idiot. And that's unfortunate, but that's how we're conditioned. That doesn't mean that every parent out there has to say that little Sarah or little Hakim is the perfect person in the world, and we don't need to coddle our children, but we need to find those places in ourselves. And you can start this when you're young, where you're still feeling that something you like or something about you is not acceptable, or you feel down about it. I've got a friend that has a problem with one of their body features, and it was probably because somebody said something about that body part when they grew up, but they could never really accept that body part because they have this story playing in their head like a record. So if the first step could simply be finding those things about yourself that you don't like and that you put down, that's a really good strategy to find those things. I don't like my eyes because somebody said this about my eyes. I used to have a really big issue about body hair, because growing up in Australia, people didn't have body hair like me. I'm Mediterranean and we have body hair everywhere. So I didn't like it. And that was when I started to realize there were so many things about my body I didn't like. And I started to see, where did that thought come from? So I did a little bit of detective work. And most of the time, if you think about why are we trying to do anything in our life, if you actually sat down and asked yourself, why do I find this important? It's usually because somebody else has told you, if you make a lot of money, you're going to be important in society, or people will think you're cool. Or if you do this thing like everybody else on Instagram, then you'll be like everybody else on Instagram. We're motivated, we're social animals. So that's, it's very natural to want to be what everybody else thinks is cool. It's a natural part of our thing. But you have to start to ask yourself, when does it start to be that I'm striving to be this thing that really doesn't suit me or doesn't actually give me any joy? And the other part goes back to what you're saying about when you really love, like when my partner says, why are you so sensitive to the movies? I am sensitive. Like sometimes we don't spend enough time, Patty, understanding how we are or how we feel. And that to me is the first mistake of our species today. We're too much focused on maybe our external qualities, but we don't look at how we receive life. We don't We don't spend time contemplating, why do I love words in a music song? We don't feel as much as we are capable of. We're really enormous instruments, as far as I see us. We're human instruments that are able to feel in many, many layers, some of us more than others, of course. So I think that's the problem. Most of us are so cultivated and conditioned to be something that we spend 30, 40, 50 years avoiding how we are, and we don't really see that. So the other piece, first step I usually do is see all the negative thoughts that you have about yourself. But the other piece is, what are the things that really make you feel alive? What are those things that make you want to get out of bed, that make you feel very emotional, make you feel very connected? And most of us don't spend a lot of time on that because we're too busy fulfilling society expectations. And our society is expecting us to become seeking pleasure, but not really seeking to get fulfillment. So we have a pleasure-based society versus what really gives you nourishment, what really makes you feel alive. We don't care about that. We just want to get that quick fix. So it's a big thing to stop and say, no, I don't want to do that. What do I really want? And I hear some people also struggle with knowing what they want. But that's usually because when they were young, they weren't really encouraged to sort of feel for extended periods of time. I had a lot of time growing up being able to feel, and I find people were maybe too busy. We're giving children too many activities to do stuff when they need to be doing more feeling and thinking about that. Oh, what do I feel? Oh, I like this. Why do I like it? I like it because of this. So giving kids more opportunities to feel and then reflect would allow them to expand that feeling part of their nature and not think so much, do people like me? But what do I feel?
And that kind of goes into my next question. You teach about feeling and sensing in the body as a pathway to having better relationships. Can you describe the importance of feeling and sensing and how this helps your students with building better relationships?
Yeah, a lot of, if we don't have enough time to feel what we're feeling, what happens is we get conditioned to stop feeling and to think those feelings are not important. So that's the first obstacle. Our society goes, oh, that takes too much time, move on. And then we go, oh, okay, well, that's not really that important. And I work with some people who are older, like 65 plus, mm-hmm. and I see this pattern. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you're 65 and you've got plenty of time. Just let yourself have time to feel. But because they've been conditioned that feeling's not important, oh, don't worry about that. That's a bit uncomfortable, messy, or too much information. So in relationships, having time to feel, it connects us back to when we're babies, our mother's holding us, and you don't have language, you don't have a job, you don't have to go anywhere. You're just being held by your mum. And she's going, oh, do-boo-bee-da-ba-boo-boo, or she's feeling her feelings. She's not saying, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this and chopping off her feelings. Maybe she's got to heat up the milk or get something ready, but she's having this unedited emotion and feeling with the child. And that's what we're all looking for. We're looking for that in the moment. That's what I said earlier, that gold of what we're looking for is there's no time, there's no space, we're just in the moment and we're experiencing joy. And in relationships, if you can cultivate that possibility, what happens is that a lot of the rubbish that we carry just dissolves. It just, you forget about it. And so with clients, what I have to encourage is that for themselves to allow feeling so that they can start to expand those emotions that maybe they've cut off. They've said they're not that valuable. Nobody really listens. Nobody really cares about that. They have to create activities, habits where they start to really allow that to expand. And Patty, it can be really diverse. It can be as simple as, you know, for some people, it's taking a bath and just allowing themselves to feel music. And for other people, it can be doing some artwork. For other people, it can be playing music, just allowing themselves to have extended periods of allowing themselves to feel. For other people, it will be necessary to try that in relationship to somebody so that they're doing something with a friend or a family member over whether they're allowing their feelings to be expanded. So the other thing that happens when we don't allow our feelings to be expanded is we don't learn how to give words to our feelings. We might have a very limited range of language for our feelings, which unfortunately is what they're teaching some kids with those apps that describe emotions. When I grew up, we didn't have apps to describe emotions. We had pop music, we had dance, we had our fashion, we had art, we had a lot of communication, talking to our friends. We did a lot of interactive and expansive ways of describing our feelings. We might not use one word. We might write a poem. We might complain to our friends for a long time. So unfortunately, if we don't have activities for young people to cultivate more language, more space to feel the feeling and then language about it, they learn that it's not really significant. And religious practices and spiritual practices for years have given space to expressing that feeling. But those religion may not be very fashionable or popular anymore. Spiritual practices are very individual now. So you can meditate by yourself, but that doesn't really cultivate relationships. So I think our feeling and our sensing in relation to others is something that our society has started to say is less and less important. Whereas for me, it's the opposite. We need to do that now. We've been given everything we need at an individual level. We've got everything in the first world or modern countries, and it's not making us happy. What are we missing? We're missing that ability to feel in relationship, in connection to somebody and to a group of people. And that's what we can start to cultivate. And I do that with finding ways for my clients to build relationships where they can feel more of who they are emotionally, expand that into art or creativity or maybe discussion for some people. Some people really relate to words, so they want to use their language skills. So whatever the client starts, what I do typically is when they start to feel something, because I have a strong ability to feel, I start to experience the joy of what they're feeling. And that gives validation to what they're feeling, and they start to feel it expand. And that's what I discovered as a dancer. When I allow things to expand, the energy actually expanded. And you can do a whole show like that. You can create a performance like that. Whole artistic works are based on allowing feelings to expand. And artists don't talk about that. So the regular person needs to learn that they have that capacity in them to feel and have that expand so that the relationships can have more pleasure and more fulfillment and sensation and satisfaction in that expression of themselves.
So Angela, you mentor and teach healers, empaths, coaches, and others in the helping professions. How do you help those struggling with picking up their clients' energy or feelings too much? Because that's what they do. They absorb those feelings. How do you help them not pick it up and keep it with them?
Yeah. So one of the problems with healers and empaths is that they like to help people and they think they're a good person because they're helping. So that image of yourself, usually I have to help them understand, why do you want to help people? And then we need to look at what are healthy boundaries around that, around helping. When I feel something, I don't need to edit that. I feel what I'm feeling. And I don't think it's natural to say to not feel. I've had enough experience trying that to realize it actually just makes me feel not myself. And also throughout my life, I've gone through periods naturally where I shut down. So naturally, like a flower opens and it will close. But eventually, when we work with the heart, it will flower and it will open and it stays open. And you don't need to do constant work on boundaries as a healer or empath. But in the beginning, when especially with people starting with healing, they'll naturally will be an empath, they'll pick up, and that's one of their skills. But they start to think, I have to be this type of person for this client to like me. Mm. And that's where usually the problems are. It's not that they're picking up. Picking up is natural. It's that they think they have to stay on the phone longer than the end of the session because this person's suffering and they need my help. They make up these stories when actually the session is, it's this session, it finishes at this time and that's the end. And they have to work out a practical way to say, okay, I have to go now. Thank you for this session. It's finished. So a lot of the time, the stories, the image of themselves as a healer or empath or a helping person is what's interfering with their gifts. So usually I work on that. And then we also learn, because sometimes people, it's an unfortunate part of being human. We think when people are traumatized and we feel that trauma, it's an irony. We start to blame the person who's traumatized for making us feel their trauma. Mm-hmm. Or we might think that trauma is too much for me, which is very, very normal. There's lots of people who have compassion fatigue in the helping professions. It's normal if someone is dealing with war to be traumatized. So one thing we have to look at is what sort of people do you want to help? Because sometimes a healer or empath thinks they have to help everybody, and you don't. You have to really know, I want to help these sorts of people. And sometimes a part of a journey, a life of a healer or empath is to realize through burnout, actually, I can't help these people anymore. I'm not going to work here. I'm going to go somewhere else. And this happens a lot, not just in the helping professions. It happens in the corporate world, you know so well, Patty, like you get to that level where you're like, I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. That's your spirit basically saying it's time to go do something else. And you've got to be aware that you're not just, some people have one life path and that's their profession. They're a doctor for the whole life. That's their life path. For others, it's not that clear cut. I've never had one job in my life and I used to tear myself up about it. Why can't you just be normal? I'm not. So I had to adjust to that. I had to accept my life has many hills and valleys. And that's part of my life path. And then discover that joy of that particular life path. And then that also helps the healer and the helping person realize, when I get these experiences of taking on too much energy, what's actually my spirit trying to make me do here? And unfortunately, healers are, they are here on earth to pick up the collective energy as well, which maybe some healers don't realize. But you're not always here to just work one-on-one. A lot of healers and empaths are here to help the collective. And some of them take on this martyr complex, like, oh, look at me, I'm doing all this work for the collective and nobody cares because they don't see it. Actually, it's very easy once you know that you're picking up for the collective to go, oh, I will just do a prayer, or you do Reiki. Okay, I will just feel the divine come in now to do the work. So healers, actually, we've got secrets that a lot of the regular people don't have. So sometimes I have to help the empath or get beyond their complaining, because they sometimes are picking up for the collective, and that makes you miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to learn when you're doing that, because I'm a master of picking up. I'm a sponge, and it's been the biggest teacher in my life, because I thought I was not doing it. I didn't know. I was very ignorant. But once I started to see, oh, you're doing it again. Here we go. There's no judgment about it. There's no whinging. I'm just like, oh, that's interesting. Look what I did. Okay. And then I do my healing and it's gone. That means as a healer, then your capacity to help increases. And so I work with some of them to teach them about that. Because if you don't get beyond that lesson as a healer, what happens is you're just whinging a lot. And, it's normal to whinge and vent, I think, sometimes, but your energy, I mean, it's like when I was in hospital, I was whinging a lot. I was a real victim in hospital, and I learned from that. I learned that I was so wrapped up in my own victimhood that I couldn't even heal. So then it took a year, because my body was very destroyed, it took a year just to recognize that I was doing that. And sometimes as a healer, we want answers straight away, but sometimes you need to learn how to see your patterns that may be very stubborn patterns, and that will take a bit of time to work out as well.
How do you do work with these people to help them get beyond that? And I think you answered how you work with them and how you teach them to not pick up the collective. And
I don't teach them to not pick up.
Oh, okay.
It's awareness of when they are.
Awareness. Okay.
Because it's like trying to say, don't breathe.
Yeah.
Like, stop breathing. Okay, don't pick up. And
it's true. You can't control what you're feeling. Yeah.
And the other thing, that's the irony, is the reason you are picking up is because your spirit is trying to show you, pay attention to the collective. You are not the collective, because you have this capacity to feel and to have compassion, or to ask for divine to come in, or to pray, whatever you do, whatever your technique is, whatever your healing ability is, you have that gift. So your divine is saying, don't be a sucker and just be stuck in that emotion or what you're picking up. Do something with it. And if you don't get that lesson, you're just going to keep picking up and feeling crap.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I used to feel dumpy. I used to feel like, oh, why do I feel so fat and dumpy? And suddenly, after a few years, I sort of went, oh, you're feeling that because of the environment that you're in. It was a different city that I was living in. And I didn't realize until I left that city. Mm-hmm. So moving around for me was a huge teacher. And one of the reasons I've had a life of moving different locations was so I could learn what the vibration was of a location and how I changed. And if I didn't move to different locations, I wouldn't have learned that. So sometimes your spirit will keep on giving you a lesson and will make you pick up until you actually work out that you're picking up. And unfortunately, we might just spend years spinning that wheel,
mm-hmm.
Until you actually recognize it. And then it's easy. It's just like, oh, okay. But I know that it's not simple. It's just that the lesson keeps, I have seen this too many times now, the lesson keeps coming back until you get it.
Angela, can you tell me and the listeners a little bit about energy body of self-acceptance? Is that people's struggle with knowing what love is, and relationships teach them how to learn what love is and what love is not, but that can change, can create a lot of insecurity or self-doubt, and they may make a lot of mistakes, which can deepen their distrust of themselves. What do you offer that can help those who distrust their instincts or develop habits where they shut down their feelings to avoid reviewing those memories over and over again, where they've experienced shame and discomfort or even abuse?
Yeah, so the energy body of self-acceptance is a simple program where you look at that inner dialogue, the negative self-talk, and we start there. And underneath all of the negative self-talk, the energy body of self-acceptance shows you what's actually there in your body. What's that resource of love there? Because the inner dialogue will have said a lot of stories that interrupt that. So shame is a huge one. It'll be quite destructive and it'll override. And I've worked with clients where we've got to a good place with the shame, and then it'll come back. And the client gets disturbed because they thought, I thought I was in a good place.
Mm-hmm.
But the shame comes back. And then it starts to make them feel not capable, because they were in a good place. They did get some sense of self-acceptance, or that who they are is a powerful human being. But then the shame, especially if it's shame from trauma, there's all sorts of levels of trauma, but shame connected to childhood trauma is very strong, can be stronger. So it can make people feel like I can't, as an adult, can't really move forward. So often what I do with the energy body of self-acceptance is just allow, the program has different exercises to allow your body to feel. It's my simple solution. It's what worked for me. It doesn't necessarily work for everyone. And ironically, now 30 years later, from when I started this work, the more I allow people to feel, and sometimes when I'm working one-on-one, I might be very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking a lot today, but I'm very quiet. And that space starts to expand. So the energy body of self-acceptance has exercises to help you feel your body expand on the energy level, on the feeling level. And again, it's not necessarily that you feel any part of yourself. You're just allowing the body to feel, allow the body to have a sense of space.
Mm-hmm.
And in what I've noticed over time with repetition of those exercises is that the body starts to have its own relaxation and confidence. The body starts to feel protected by you. The body starts to feel heard by you. Instead of us pushing our body, making our body do things, the body starts to go, you are listening to me. And then that creates a shift in the person, because now their body starts to feel more safe and feel more nurtured and listened to. So they start to make naturally different choices. So the energy body of self-acceptance came because I had a lot of that development of the program came. I had a lot of negative self-talk, and it was so destructive. And the only way I knew for my body to recover was that if I gave some simple exercises to feel. So it can help people just by the simplicity of the program. You can just begin to start to feel. And of course, by repeating the exercises. And I use the energy body of self-acceptance is the very simple program. So a lot of that is the foundation of what we do in the workshops, like Dance for Joy. Dance for Joy, we do interactive exercises. And I might have people in partners where they support each other to feel. Or we do it as a group. We're doing it collectively. And that has a different impact on the body as well, because then the body can feel safe in a group, which people may not have much experience with.
So, Angela, how does dance and movement meditation build better relationships?
Yeah, most of my work is really based on allowing ourselves to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And dance and movement meditation, I used to use dance at a very more aerobic, like interactive and high energy type dance. Movement meditation is where you really slow down and just allow the body to experience the movement. So it's usually in more high energy dance, there's this choreography or steps or techniques that you might learn to use the body parts and use the body parts in coordination. In movement meditation, it's the opposite in a way. We're looking at how the slowing down of the movement allows you to experience your energy. And I had that experience in dance as well when I was starting to do slower movement, mainly the Sufi movement. When I started with the Sufi movement, the movements were so slow that I thought my arms were going to fall off because we had our arms in the air and I didn't know what was holding them up. So one movement for 40 minutes, I think, was the arms in the air. And I thought, am I doing this? I didn't know how I was doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
So then it made me realize there is other ways to hold my body, not just by thinking of dance. It made me actually change my whole perception of the body. What was holding my arms up? And the space around me. So what I discovered in dance and the movement meditation, the slowing down of the movement, was that in our perception of our feelings, we actually have no real, we're not static. There's no one thing that we are. We are actually quite fluid, where we have potential and potency in us that we don't understand. We have feelings that can sometimes create movement that you don't even need muscle strength to do, or you don't need training to do. So I also had the gift of working with dancers who were not professional and saw them doing incredible dance movements. So we started to explore, how was that possible? Why were they able to do a movement without being trained? And that made me realize that our relationships are constantly a process of really exploring that. How in that moment, in that relationship, does my mind say all this rubbish about the relationship, or can I just allow the relationship to sort of breathe, have an experience of what's going on in the relationship, and then feel what is underneath? So I learned through dance and movement meditation that there's no real truth into what we think the body is or what we think the mind is. It's a constant journey of interaction. And I think dance in itself, because it's usually done as a group, or you can do it in your room, but you're relating to music There's a relationship embedded in dance and movement. Even with movement in space, you're relating to space. And that itself, the relationship between you and the space, has enormous diversity and potential. And that's how I see we can take those teachings and bring that to our relationships. The relationships, our minds will try to say things all the time. That's fine, but it's not necessarily the reality. And there's so much more potential there. And the mind is usually too busy and trying to shut that down. So what can, if I take the teachings of just the movement meditation and that you can experience yourself more fully, then we can bring that to our relationships. What's between the two people? What's in that space? It does mean slowing down, and I think our society doesn't like that. But I do see a lot of people now isolated, alone at home, and kind of not really sure why they're here. So why not do something with movement where you can experience yourself in relationship to others and experience, if you're going to be at home, what is something you can do to experience more of the people that you're at home with if you're with someone else? So that's just some of the things. I've got more on that from my YouTube channel as well. So I'll have that YouTube channel at Stance with Angela, where I look at movement and love and how does dance help us to love? Where is dance helping us to grow in our sense of self and who we are?
Angela, you also work with people recovering in their body after an illness or trauma by helping them understand how to enjoy their body and their personality. Can you share some strategies to get a better relationship with your body and a recovery of the body after an illness?
A lot of what I can share is simple connection to the body and with your hands. So I have a few techniques on the Dance with Angela YouTube channel as well. When I was ill, I couldn't move too much, but I could put my hands on different parts of the body and just allow my body to feel that hand. Now, for some people, that seems really nothing. But if you take some breaths and start to allow yourself to feel, there can be, for some people, a deep comfort in that.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me one day in hospital, took me all day just to do that, just to put my hand on my body and breathe. So after illness as well, I think there's this really unexplored part of illness, because sometimes when you're ill, you just sort of want to forget about it. But the recovery phase is quite interesting because it connects to some of the things I learned from movement meditation, where when we slow down, there's actually this enormous potential. It's just the nature of reality. If you look at the atom, you can't really slow down the speed of the atom, but if you start to really look at the atom, there's more and more things that you can see inside it. And in recovery phases, that's a similar process. The more you enjoy that process of just being, touching something or doing small repetitive movements. I became a big fan of exercise bands from physiotherapy.
Oh, yeah. And
yeah, I still use them now, even though I've got my body back, because sometimes I'll just do a stretch and I'll hold with the band. And it's something that also has a tension, or there's an opposite force.
Mm-hmm.
So many times in recovery, you do get a physiotherapist in Australia or a physical therapist in the US. Often you get that service when you're physically recovering. And the big reason is that there's somebody there to work with you, to give you something to work with. So that's a large part of recovery, to really find things to support you, to work with you, and to find movements where you're taking the slowness of the movement and feeling yourself expand, because often your body's contracted,
mm-hmm.
or if you have a mental disability, your brain is really struggling as well. So you need to allow that brain to just take its time and to feel expansion, even though it feels uncomfortable and not quite right. I know we were talking earlier about COVID and the brain fog. So that's another thing. People with long COVID and trying to push your body doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you take something very slowly and just allow? And often we don't look at this. We look at it in healing, but in the medical industry, they don't. But usually the body is sick because it wants you to slow down and it needs you to explore what's in that slow, still process. So then you can open up to some other capacity that's dormant inside of you. And medicine's beginning to go there, which is fascinating to me. But we're just at this age of the species where we're experiencing collective fatigue. And we're learning, okay, what does this do to our species? What is this fatigue phenomena? How do you recover from it? I had a lot of illness over my life where I had fatigue. So I had to learn how to slow down. It's very basic. It's not that advanced, but it's a process of actually allowing your body to experience rest and stillness. And then in that, there's this other thing that unfolds. And also how to use energy, not muscle. We're still at that beginning phase, which is what Dance with Angela is all about, how to use your energy versus the muscular body, because my body wasn't really that muscular in the first place, so I had to use everything else. And I discovered that energy has a lot more range than the muscular body. So that's some of the things for illness. And for trauma and recovery, there's a lot of capacity in also your perception of yourself. So I work a lot with people's perception of themselves to see how they can look at it differently. And that takes the trauma to a different place.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Angela. How can our listeners find you or contact you about your products and services?
So the best way would be to go to my website, dancewithangela.com. And you can also follow on YouTube, the Dance with Angela YouTube channel, where I have videos. I'm a little bit behind with my video output there. And in Sydney, there's also in October 2023, we're going to have three workshops called Dance for Joy. So if you're in Sydney, Australia, you can come along to the Dance for Joy workshops, and we'll have a link in the description as well. But the YouTube channel is a great way to find out some of the different simple movement techniques as well, so that if you want to try some gentle movement and just feeling into your body, I have a lot to share on the YouTube channel.
So like and follow her on her YouTube channel, Dance with Angela. Thank you, Angela, for sharing your journey. And thank you so much for listening. And please follow us on Spotify and share this podcast with others.
Thank you for listening to Building Better Relationships with Angela and Patty. Send us a message and please like or share the podcast or donate with the Anchor Donate button. We really value your feedback.